This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. I just came across a really exciting news article.
What was that, Bob?
Well, the article came from Australia, and it told of an invention of a screen reader that can be accessed for free.
I read about that also. A graduate of Queensland University of Technology, together with his business partner,
both of whom were blind,
right, developed a free, open-source program which provides a synthetic voice to read the words on a computer screen.
Screen readers used to cost about $1,000.
The program is called Non-Visual Desktop Access.
Now it's free.
Bill, I thought you weren't able to use a mouse.
With this program, I can.
The mouse comes with the computer.
As the mouse moves across the screen, it emits a beeping noise that gets higher or lower in pitch to tell you the location of the cursor.
So, the mouse is free too.
And then the program reads the words as the cursor passes over them.
That's the way it works.
It's that easy.
And how do you access the program?
There are two ways. Either you can use a download to your own computer,
which is free,
or you can put the program on a flash drive and enter it onto any computer that you happen to be using.
It's so easy. Some of the computer staff at the RLCB Center are using it.
This sounds like something that could be very helpful to computer users who are sight impaired.
Free and easy. You know, it ought to have a special name.
What's the program called again?
A name that is, well, also free and easy.
It's called Non-Visual Desktop Access.
I got it! Mickey Mouse!
Bob, what are you talking about?
A name for the screen reader program. The program is free, and the mouse is easy, so call it Mickey Mouse.
It already has a name, Non-Visual Desktop Access.
What's wrong with Mickey Mouse?
I think you might just run into copyright problems. You might have to pay for the use of the name.
Oh, that means it wouldn't be free.
And that wouldn't be easy.
I guess I'll have to come up with another name for it.
It already has a name, given to it by its inventors. It's called Non-Visual Desktop Access.
But that's not easy to say.
Well, then how about NVDA?
NVDA. Ooh, I like it.
Now, isn't that easy?
Yeah, and it's free.
Bob, you said free.
I like free.
Bob, what got you so interested in this program?
Well, I'm having problems with my computer.
You're not sight impaired.
No, not yet. And I thought this program might be helpful to me.
I'm almost afraid to ask, but what is the problem?
Well, it was the first computer that I ever bought, and I didn't know a lot about them.
Funny about things like that.
Go on.
Well, I didn't want to spend a lot of money, and then I saw an ad for a personal computer that would add, subtract, multiply, and divide, and it also had its own spell-correcting device.
That sounds pretty all-purpose.
Well, I thought so. Later on, though, I found out that I couldn't use it to play solitaire. But it was cheap.
How cheap?
$10 for $1.
A computer? $10 for $1?
Yeah, and very compact. One end did the calculations, and the other end made the corrections.
I've never heard of such a thing. What brand was it?
I had a choice of brands. I remember one was Mongol, and the other one was Ticonderoga.
Ticonderoga?
Bill, they're pencils, and the spell check is an eraser.
I see.
Oh, not really. After a while, they didn't work very well anymore. Now I use one, and, well, you can't even read what's on the page.
Imagine that.
That's why I thought that new screen reader might be some help.
Bob?
Remember, it said that the program was free?
And your computer came equipped with a mouse?
Well, it must have. Every day I find more teeth marks in it.
I'd like to introduce our first guest. Dr. Charles Walker is an authority on blindness, has developed the world's first identity model for sight-impaired individuals, is adjunct professor at NC State, and also runs his own consulting firm.
Dr. Walker, welcome to our program today.
Well, thank you, Bill, and I'm happy to be here with Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'd like to correct one thing. I am on the faculty at NC State. I'm an adjunct professor in the Department of Counselor Education, and I'm a nationally certified counselor and a distance credential counselor. I'm also on the board of directors with Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I happen to be visually impaired. So I'm happy to be here and happy to meet you.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about your early life.
My early life. Where do I start? Well, I'm born and bred in North Carolina. I did have some vision problems in my early life, and I attended Governor Moorhead School for the Blind from kindergarten until about the third grade. I left Moorhead and went to public school in the third grade, so I could see pretty good. Wound up going to high school, to Sanderson High School, and I could drive and, you know, watch movies and play baseball and basketball, playing on the basketball team, pick up touch football games and things of that nature.
Now, when you first became a student at the Governor Moorhead School,
yes,
did you start out reading Braille?
No, I learned some Braille, but I primarily read large print.
And then when you went to public school, did you continue with a large print or did you graduate to standard size print?
I started out with large print books, but they were embarrassing to me. And I quickly moved to standard print because I could see it. That's the way I went through the school.
Did you have to have any special magnification or special modifications?
Yeah, I wore eyeglasses, corrective lenses. They were really thick back in those days. They didn't have a feather-thin lens that they have today. I could do a lot of things without my glasses at that time. I played basketball without my eyeglasses, and I was pretty good.
You played for Sanderson?
I did.
What position did you play, center?
Center. Switch off with a little bit of power forward. Four and five play basically the same positions.
What years did you play basketball?
Yeah, I was in high school from 77 to 80 and played 1977 through 79. Because I got my eye hurt in high school, I did not complete high school. I had a few scholarships to go to college to play ball, and I wound up getting hurt with my eye and lost a lot of sight. And so I wasn't able to accept the scholarships. Got better after that. My eyesight got better, at least in my right eye. I lost a lot in my left eye, but left high school, and I just went out to Wake Tech and got me a GED. That's the road I went down. Then I went to work, and I did all kinds of work, and I wound up working for the public school system as a teacher's aide with emotionally handicapped children, and that kind of started me down the whole mental health field. I worked at Holly Hill Hospital and Dorothea Dixon, Wake County Mental Health. That's where I wound up losing my sight. Started losing my sight in 86, and by 89, I guess it was all gone. I got terminated, got fired because I lost my sight. And it was a five-year court battle. We were still in court, and we settled the case in 92. I could think I went back to school in 1990. I had started working on my associate's degree early on. I guess I did wind up with my associate's degree in 1990. And my bachelor's in 92, and then I went back to work for a while in mental health for a stint, and then I went to graduate school.
Where's your associate degree and your bachelor's degree?
Oh, Rutledge. Rutledge is where I got my associate's in business administration and great institution. I got my bachelor's degree in sociology and went to NC State and got a master's in counselor education, entered the doctoral program, got my PhD in 2008. But I've been a guest lecturer in many classes, taught many classes, and I started my teaching in NC State in 2009, right after I graduated.
How many classes do you usually teach in a semester? Does this vary?
As an adjunct professor, you teach what they tell you to teach, and there's no set schedule agenda. And right now, none of the adjuncts are doing very much teaching at all. That's why I'm a nationally certified counselor and a distance credential counselor. And I have my own business, and we do assistive technology. I train people on how to use screen reading software, and I do troubleshooting for them if I can help them out from a user level. So we do other things.
Tell me, you're probably as technologically savvy as any blind person that I know. Tell our listeners about some of the forms of technology that you use.
I've always liked technology, even before I lost my sight. Adjusting to blindness was tough for me, as it is for most people. One of the problems I had adjusting to blindness was two things, the cane, using the long white cane, and number two, Braille. Division of Service for the Blind at the Rehab Center, where I went first, they kind of shoved these things down your throat.
Mm-hmm.
I was an adult when I lost my sight, and I did not want anything to do with a cane or anything to do with Braille, quite honestly. Although I think Braille is an important tool, I think blind people should use, should certainly learn Braille. And I did learn it. I learned grade one Braille in like a week, maybe two. And I do use it today. But for practical purposes, for reading books and the massive amounts of materials I have to sift through, it's just too slow. But for a lecture or notes or Braille on my microwave at home or file folders or something like that, it's most useful, very practical. And there's just no other way for a blind person to identify their paperwork like that. I like the computers. I like the computer software. I always have. I use Job Accessible Speech, JAWS, and it just reads everything for the most part. It allows me to be functional with email, surfing the web, filling out forms, typing in forms, downloading books for the love of God from the NLS, which I also love, and other MP3 files you can access from reading the Bible, which faith is a very big component in my life. But I use a talking cell phone, you know, to have the KNFB reader. I have a Victor Reader Stream, which is a talking MP3 player with my books and my music, text files, and I take audio notes on that. Very useful technology. I love talking software. I usually have a talking watch and a lot of talking stuff at home, clocks and, you know, buzzers and things.
Yes. Now, you brought up something interesting. You said you take audible notes. So how did you describe your note take?
Well, yeah, it's like a recording. It's just a recording.
Do you speak into it, or do you just turn it on and let whoever's doing the lecture talk?
Yeah, it's a recorder, so you can record whoever's talking. So I use technology, have always used technology since I went blind in my life. Started out with a visual tech. When I had some vision, I quickly moved to a talking computer and a scanner and Kurzweil software for, you know, reading documents. So that's what I use.
Well, tell me, changing the subject, how did you meet your wife?
Well, my wife Cheryl, we met in 1988, and she's my second wife. My first wife, Renee, mother of my children, she passed away. We had met at my grandmother's birthday party, actually.
How many children do you have?
Well, I have two. We have six altogether. They're all grown now, thank God. And we got grandchildren. My stepson, Andre, the oldest one, he's in the Coast Guard, proudly serving our country. He's out in Washington State, him and my daughter-in-law. So it's Andre and Heather. He named his first son after me. I appreciated that.
Well, that's quite an honor.
You don't get any better than that with you.
That's quite an honor.
Your stepson does that, yeah. And I coached my son's basketball team. It's called the Mighty Minnows. And we, at Optimus Park. And I was the first blind coach with Parks and Recreation. And we won every game we played. Told those boys, I said, I believe in you, 6 to 9 year old. I said, I believe in you. And my goal was that they all score at point in the basketball season. And they did. I was so proud of those boys. We still run into them now. They're grown men now. They're 24, 25 years old now. And they've gone to college, and so I'm proud of all of them now. I also want to talk to you about my research interests.
Well, we can get right into it.
Okay. Well, when you go to graduate school in a counselor education program, in a PhD program, they expect you to develop your own theories, positions, and a framework about something important. And so there's nothing more important to me than this whole process of identity development for people who are blind or visually impaired. I've looked at all of the identity development models out there, and there are none addressing the needs and concerns and issues associated with persons who are blind or visually impaired. And so I put forth an effort to develop the world's first, and published, by the way, the world's first blind identity development model for people who are blind or visually impaired.
Now, you bring up an interesting point. What are the existing identity development models designed for? What segment of the population?
Well, they're kind of generic. One size fits all for everyone. Mm-hmm. For example, the first one that you may be familiar with is Sigmund Freud's psychosexual identity development model from birth to about adolescence. And it deals with issues associated with how one forms an identity from a psychosexual point of view. Erik Erikson, his protege who worked for him, across the lifespan. So Erikson goes from birth to old age or to death. Those are your key. You have William Cross, who deals with a black identity development model. He looks at how African Americans form their racial identity development. And so you have women's identity development models. What we're missing in the literature is anything associated for people who are blind or visually impaired in terms of identity development. And so I wanted that have my experience represented and experienced for a whole lot of other people. And so I developed that model. It's four stages. It moves from the process of identity development for people who are blind or visually impaired, moves across a continuum from adjustment to dependence to independence to interdependence. Now, that's what I published. I've since added another stage of transcendence, which goes beyond interdependence. So from adjustment to dependence to independence to interdependence. And each one of those stages has its own features. I don't think it stops when you get at independence. You're more functional at a level of interdependence because the environment is not set up truly for us to really be independent, for blind people to be independent. I mean, we don't have the infrastructure that would allow us, and I guess you would agree, Bill, to just do it all by ourselves. Until they have the Knight Industries 2000, the kit car, they would talk. And I can get in and say, kit, take me where I want to go. Then until we get there, the environment's not ready for me yet. And the whole process of losing my sight, I lost everything, even my first wife. I lost not only my sight, but my job and my house and my independence. I lost my cars and I lost my money and my credit and I lost my first wife. But I also lost a sense of self. And at 26 years old, I'm like, whoa, man, what do you do now? Wasn't used to the new position and the way people started treating me as a blind person as opposed to just a person.
Am
I not a man now? Those shared experiences that we had when you go to a restaurant and my mother and I would go out to eat and they would ask her, my mother, what I wanted. And so they were like, how do I make sense out of this? It was a new world. I didn't know what to do with that. So that's why I did this identity development model, because people, they don't teach blind people that you can move to a higher place and that you should move to a higher place of functioning and development and appreciation and understanding of your own disability. In fact, I don't teach that blindness is a disability. I teach that it is. But, I mean, at some point, I believe you can see blindness as a blessing. That's based on my faith belief, because I only can do this thing by faith. That's what kept me from and wanting to die, is to have something to hold on. And I read the Bible, Exodus 4th chapter, 11th verse. And God told Moses, he says, who made the dumb and the deaf and the seeing and the blind? I said, what? And I read it again. I said, God asked Moses, who made the blind? So God made the blind, so I'm okay. So I'm good to go. So let's go do what we do. So I never stop. Nothing can ever hold me back now. Nothing can stop me, no matter what.
Dr. Walker, in the time that we have left, tell our listeners what you would consider some of the greatest hurdles that you've had to overcome in achieving your success.
Some of the greatest hurdles that I had to overcome were in the very beginning when I first lost my sight. And they were associated with myself. I think I was my own worst problem. And that was to the extent that I had internalized the messages, the distortions, and out-and-out lies about the meaning of blindness and what life could be for persons who are blind. For me, I didn't want to be blind. I'd rather be dead. But I was told that I should be dead, that I was told and informed that by this society, by a sighted society, that life would be so difficult as a person who is blind that it would not be worth living. And that's the most satanic lies that's ever been told. Because God made blind people. And when you put your faith in God, then you live for him. And so I chose to live for my God. And everything I do is because of him. And I truly walk by faith and not by sight, literally. And blind people represent, as I've written and published, that actually their blindness, the conditional blindness, represents the very glory of God itself. And I'm not a preacher, I'm a counselor. But that was the most difficult thing for me to overcome, is the distortions that I had been made to believe. But when I got it straight in the beginning, then I know that nothing that could stop me, no weapon, no power, no force, no condition, no situation that could ever stop me from doing whatever I wanted to do, to achieving whatever I wanted to achieve. And so what I did for God. Whatever I accomplished because of God. He strengthened me when I was all alone, when I was by myself. He was with me. He carried me. And everything I put my hand to turned to gold, because I put the work in. I put the effort in. But God opened the doors. I would be nowhere without a sincere faith in God. My greatest achievement, I guess, is raising my children, all of my children, doing something for somebody else, helping out other people, and being an encouragement, hopefully an inspiration to them, both blind and sighted, to know who they are.
Well, thank you, Dr. Walker. It's certainly been a pleasure for me to meet you and to visit with you today here
you,
on
Bill.
The Triangle Radio Reading Service.
I appreciate it, and I look forward to getting to know you better.
Welcome to another edition of TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin as we present another episode of The Search for Blind Justice. Our episode opens to the sound of cattle. Lunch is just over, and the cowboys are getting ready for the short drive on into the river crossing. Off to one side is the chuck wagon, with the trail boss and old Cookie talking.
Well, Cookie, another few days ought to do it, and we'll be in Kansas City.
And I'm sure looking forward to Kansas City.
Me too, to finally get out of the saddle.
Yeah, but things are changing there. It's not just some old third-rate cattle town anymore. You walk down Main Street, and you're not knocked down by the smell of the cattle pens. And they got indoor plumbing for the hotels now.
And downtown's got electricity.
Well, that sure does me a lot of good.
Oh, Cookie, it's just one of the signs that the town's getting modern. They have paved streets and trolley cars and fancy theaters. I hear they even have a skyscraper in Kansas City that's 7 stories tall.
7 stories? Now that's just about as high as any building ought to grow.
Maybe, but there you have it. Everything's up to date in Kansas City.
You can go get lost in that 7-story building, but what's got me excited is an old friend of mine opened a new cooking school in Kansas City. I've known her since she was a child. Her name is Madam Julia, and I taught her everything I knew about cooking. Now that she's all grown up, she went away to some fancy school in Paris called Le Cordon Rouge, learned a few new wrinkles, and is going to teach them to me. I figure it could make next year's drive a little more interesting. Lots of fancy things they do with chicken.
And where are we going to find chicken out here on the range?
You may be surprised. I hear there's a lot of things that taste just like chicken. A few secret herbs and spices, and you may not know what's really on the plate. Just tastes good.
That reminds me, something the boys asked me to talk to you about. Steak and beans is pretty common fare, and we all know what steak and beans look like. Lately, there have been some things on the dinner plate that nobody can recognize. You haven't been adding any of those smart pills, have you? We're as smart as we need to be.
Tasted good, didn't it?
Yeah.
Well, then, don't ask.
And you won't tell.
Fair enough.
Speaking of fair...
I thought we were getting rid of those segues.
Not a chance. Where there's a will, there's a segue. So as I was saying, speaking of fair, did you have time to restock the wagon while we were coming through Scarborough?
Sure did. You can't make a decent quiche without dill and a little minced onion. Plus, they had a deal on some specialty items.
Like what?
Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
Hold on, Cookie. Someone's riding up.
Whoa there. Hey, you the trail boss?
Yeah, what can I do for you?
Well, we've got a situation up at the river crossing, and if we don't get it solved, we may have a bit of a problem.
Richard, we have to get to the crossing. We're short of water, and the cattle are getting mighty thirsty.
I know. What seems to be the problem?
Well, the community at the crossing planned a big barn dance for the cowboys coming through.
Hot dog, a hoedown!
Well, there's the problem. You know how cowboys like to dance. Well, the musicians were supposed to have been here yesterday, and none of them arrived. And the boys are getting a bit tempered up.
What can we do?
Well, we have a couple of harmonica players and one old fiddler, but we need a piano player. You have anyone here who can play the piano?
My friend, we have a piano player that can make your feet hit the dance floor while the rest of your body is still sitting in the chair. and he is so good that he can even cook up a load of flapjacks and put them on top of the piano while he's turning the pages of the music. Cookie, come over here.
But doesn't he have trouble finding the keys?
Do you know how to get on your horse without seeing which end is the tail?
Sure.
Likewise. And I don't need to see the keys to know where they are. And if I know anything about local pianos, they're all out of tune. So why don't you take me on ahead, and I'll have this piano ready for dancing, and we'll all have a big dinner after the dance. You just keep those cows a-coming, Richard, and we'll be ready for you.
We'll be there with our dancing shoes on.
Let's get going, young feller. I've got a piano to tune. That ought to do it.
Hey, Cookie, the cattle are all watered and bedded down, and we're ready to dance. Piano ready?
Do fish swim in the ocean? Just listen.
Yeah, it's ready. Now all this dancing is going to build up an appetite. What are you planning for dinner later?
Pizza.
Pizza? What's pizza?
One of those up-to-date things I learned about last year in Kansas City. That's why I went shopping in Scarborough.
What do you use to make it?
Oh, just about anything you have around, covered with parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
And how about a little sarsaparilla for the perfect conclusion to another case of blind justice?
That opening story about the blind inventors was sure interesting. I wonder, though, was that an unusual event?
You mean, is it unusual for blind people to be inventors?
Yeah. I mean, don't you have to see a problem before you solve it? After all, that's what inventing is, solving problems.
Maybe Dr. Bill could help you with that question.
Well, good idea. Let's ask him.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
This is Dr. Bill. What's on your mind?
Dr. Bill, I was wondering about blind inventors. Isn't it hard coming up with a solution when you can't see the problem?
Why should that be? When I walk down the street, I know that there are things out there, even though I can't see them. That's what sticks are for. It's better to tap a brick wall or a curb with a stick rather than I run into it.
Oh, that's why some sight-impaired people use white canes.
Just a better designed stick.
That's a good point. When there's a problem, you can picture it without actually seeing it.
And I can also envision a solution.
Do you know of any other blind inventions?
As a matter of fact, how about dancing dots?
What are they?
Developed in 1992 by blind musician Bill McCann, it is basically a method of translating music into Braille.
I've heard of this program. It allows blind people the same access to musical scores as sighted people.
And it lets them transcribe their own compositions into Braille.
Wow. Anything else?
A mathematician for Rand Corporation, Sam Janiski, developed a method for projecting magnified text onto video screens.
And he's also blind?
Legally blind, yes.
Kevin Stockton in Oregon developed blind signs, a pattern of raised dots on streets that allow blind people to detect crossings and bus stops.
And one of my favorites, cruise control.
Cruise control? You mean for automobiles?
That's right. Ralph Teeter received a patent for the device in 1945. It was variously called Control-Matic, Touch-O-Matic, Press-O-Matic, Betastat, and finally, cruise control.
He must have been able to see for a long time before he went blind.
Wrong. He had been blind since the time he was 5 years old.
In spite of that, he built his first car by the time he was 12. He received a degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Pennsylvania, and in his first job following graduation, he helped develop the technology for steam turbine rotors that were used in torpedo boat destroyers during World War I.
And then came cruise control.
Used on Chrysler cars beginning in 1958 and on all Cadillacs by 1960.
Since he couldn't drive himself, why would he think of cruise control?
Now this is a funny story. He didn't drive, but other people would drive him.
And one of them was his lawyer, who couldn't talk and drive at a steady speed at the same time.
And he was quite a talker.
Well, he was a lawyer.
And after one very jerky ride,
he came up with the idea of smoothing out the conversation.
Here have been just a few more examples of the comment by Dr. Jacob Bulletin. Just because a man doesn't have any eyes, it doesn't mean that he hasn't any brains.
Boy, I'm sure glad I fit into that category.
Bob, you have the use of your eyes.
Exactly.
I think that's a signal for Dr. Bill to leave. This has been Dr. Bill. Thank you for telling me what's on your mind.
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. Conversations. The voices of TRRS.
We have as our guest today George Douglas and Randy Thompson. Welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much, Bill.
How long have you been associated with Triangle Radio Reading Service?
Bill, I started reading back in the fall of 2010. And at that time, the program that I was doing was U.S. News and World Report, and we started mixing in U.S. News and World Report with The Week magazine, looking toward the end of the year when U.S. News was actually going out of business, and so we stopped reading that in December.
Randy, tell us about your tenure here with the Reading Service.
Well, mine started, I think, Bill, back in 2008. I was wondering at the time what I was going to do in retirement. A friend of mine, in fact, he's my boss, or was my boss, where I was working, is Ed Funkhauser. And Ed said, well, why don't you go volunteer at TRRS? So I did. I came down and talked to Linda, and she said, do you like rock and roll music? And I said, well, I like all kinds of music, but rock and roll's fine, too. And she said, well, one of the people who was reading for us has just left and gone back to New York, and we have an opening for that. So she put me in for an audition, and everything went fairly well, I guess. So I've been here since 2008.
You have a sort of a unique program, Randy, which involves a lot of preparation and research before it becomes a program. Tell us a little bit about how you put it together.
Well, this is one of the things that I found most stimulating about this particular program, is that it does allow for a lot of creativity. As much as I admire and I do all the readers, and especially the live readers, because I do recorded programs, and I become spoiled by that, the advantages that go along with recording your program, it is a unique program in that I have to go to various sources, a lot of them on the Internet, and select topics for the program for each week. What I usually try to do is find one article that relates to local rock and roll, one article that relates to classic rock, one that's related to contemporary rock, and then throw in some tidbits, some other kinds of stories like that. You were asking before about people who might have listeners who might have questions to the four of us or to anybody here at TRS, but in my particular case, I'm also looking for recommendations for music or genres of music that people would like to hear, would like to see me feature on program, because every week I try to feature either a genre of rock and roll or a singer or a band or that sort of thing. So I'm always open to those kind of suggestions.
Unlike Randy's show, my program is primarily reading from the information in the Week magazine, and the one thing that I try to do is you have a lot of situations where big news will happen after a weekly goes to press, and so I try to, right before the program, if there's been a big event, and like the tsunami in Japan or the killing of Osama bin Laden are two examples that come to mind, would not be mentioned on the program at all, which is a little strange for a news magazine. So I pull the latest articles off the online service there and lead with those and then fill in with content from the program.
Tell us a little bit about your professional careers.
I actually started in radio when I was just getting out of high school and starting in college, and worked for a radio station that was also co-owned by a TV station in Richmond. Worked as a disc jockey there for a while and then got into the news department, and my degree was in journalism at the University of Richmond, so I decided to get into the television side of the business as opposed to print. Since then, I've worked in public relations for a number of years as a PR firm consultant, and most of my career was in the cable television business. In fact, I got into cable television when nobody really knew what it was, unless you lived out in the countryside somewhere, because it was used for reception. But from about the late 1970s on, cable television started becoming a programming business as well, with a lot of niche programmings, like CNN. You know, it was brand new back in 1980, and music television, ESPN, and all those things were just happening. So that's what I've been doing for, you know, most of the last 30 years.
Well, Bill, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up, and I've been asked that ever since I was very small, but especially as I went to college. I must have changed majors four or five times, and then after I got out of college, I must have changed careers two or three times at least. So I was in the U.S. Army for a couple of years. I went to West Point. I was going to be a career officer for a while. Same class as Mike Krzyzewski, although I didn't know him. He was in a different company. Went into CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and worked as a public health advisor for a couple years. Eventually went to Indiana University, where I earned my graduate degrees. And when I left Indiana, I wanted to go to a school where they had an applied kind of approach. I didn't want to be sitting in a 20 by 20 classroom studying about what was going on outside. I wanted to actually get out there and do something. So a land-grant school was a natural choice. NC State was one of the better land-grant schools, so I applied here and fortunately was given a job in the mid to late 70s. And I worked as a sociologist, primarily dealing with applied kinds of research, whether it dealt with criminology, sentencing behavior, or whether it dealt with community participation, community development, third world. Stayed with that all the way through until I went over to the dark side in about 2002. By that I mean I took a job with administration at NC State. So I became what all of us as faculty members used to dread. They were always the bad guys, but I became one of them, and I discovered it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I stayed in that job until I retired.
What experience have you had with blind people or with knowing a blind person? And did this experience have any impact on your desire to read for the reading service?
Yeah, Bill, actually, I had a very unique experience, and it goes back to the very beginning of my career. I mentioned that it started out in radio back in the mid-1960s, actually. I'd been trying to get a job at a radio station in Richmond, Virginia, and I was having difficulty because I was young and I didn't have any experience, and they want people with experience. So anyway, I finally got a job in Ashland, which is about 10 miles north of Richmond. So my first night, I was going out to the radio station. I'd actually never been in a radio studio before. Showed up at the station just about at the time that the sun was going down. Walked in the station, and it was perfectly dark. I felt there was nobody there except the door was open. I walked into the studio there, and the fellow in the control room called out to me and said, is that you, George? He said, yeah, that's me. His name was Johnny McPherson. And I walked in there. The studio was pitch black, or it wasn't completely black, but there were no lights on in the studio. Johnny was blind. He was the announcer that was on duty all by himself in this radio station this evening, and I was going out to be taught how to operate the control board. Talk about the classic case of the blind leading the blind. Anyway, so the first thing he said was, you know, I think I forgot to turn the light on. You can do that. It might help you. It doesn't do much for me. So I said, okay, well, I appreciate that because I can barely see you right now. He proceeded to show me how to operate the control board. It was one that was very similar to the one that we use here at the reading service. He knew where all of the controls were on the board, but all of the announcements that he had to read. We used to use these cartridge tapes here, and he would have a commercial with Braille on the front of the cartridge tape. Every tape in the entire station there had Braille on the front of it, so that's how he knew how to find the spot. And he had Braille on the tapes for the tape programs as well. When he was going to play a record, he knew where the record library was, and he pulled it out and listened to it on audition and queued it up. And he knew everything that was in the record library, so he could still introduce the things. The thing that was most amazing to me was he did news on the hour. And the way he did that was he listened to another radio station with a earphone while the music was on or a program was on. He would listen to headlines on another radio station, and then he would go on the air live himself and repeat those headlines and do it all from memory. I sat there and watched him do that on many occasions. So he was an amazing guy, and we got to be very good friends. He was also a minister, and he was an excellent guitar player and played in a band.
In my case, Bill, I didn't know any people with sight problems while I was growing up or even as a young adult, but I did come into contact, and there were particular events that occurred in my life where I'd come across people who I was just amazed at what they were able to do with their limited vision. That was inspirational to me. So I've always found that working around people who don't have the same advantages that I do make me feel all the more thankful for all the capacities that I can enjoy. I was struck by the fact that I was on one particular occasion standing on the corner waiting for the light to change, and I can remember they used to have, I don't know if they still do in downtown Raleigh, those bird sounds that are mechanical.
Yes. Yes.
And there was a blind person standing next to me, and the bird sound hadn't started yet, but it was springtime, and a live bird in a nest started chirping. And before I knew it, this poor person was starting to walk out into the traffic on Hillsborough Street, and fortunately a number of us grabbed her and pulled her back. And it reminded me of how dependent people are on, some people are more than others on these mechanic or man-made kinds of things that I can just take for granted. I don't have to think about them that much until something like this actually occurs. So I guess it just makes me feel all the more blessed to know that I'm aware that I have all of these advantages that everybody else has. My father-in-law had a best friend who was a watch repairman, for example, who I was introduced to, and I was just amazed. This guy was blind, but he did all this wonderful work with watches and clocks that were all over his place. In fact, it was a very noisy place to have to visit because you couldn't hear anything else with all the clocks, especially the cuckoo clocks going off all the time. But what an expert he was. And then people like you yourself, Bill, who tune pianos and so on, to me, that's just fantastic, the quality of the work that people can do despite not having all the capacities that I have. And it makes me all the more aware of the fact that I need to be thankful for all those things that I have and to use them more than perhaps I should, and to be more thankful for them as well. I can't remember who it was that said this, but it was a person with a sight impairment. She said, "The thing that gripes her the most are all you people who do have vision, and yet you can't see, or you don't see, or you refuse to see, or you don't use even that capacity to understand people as you should. You should take advantage of all those senses that you have available to you." That brought it home as well.
What attracted you to the Triangle Radio Reading Service over other organizations that you could have volunteered with?
Well, Bill, I have had some previous experience with a reading service in Virginia. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and many years ago was very active with what was then called the Virginia Voice for the Print Handicapped. I enjoyed that very much and did a number of different things with the organization there. And for as long as I've been in Raleigh, which is about 10 years now, I've been wanting to get involved with the reading service. I was actually going to a few years ago, and then when I was working, I got transferred to Charlotte for a few years. But as soon as I came back and retired, much like Randy, I was looking to figure out what I was going to do to use my time effectively, and this was one of the top things on my list, was to get involved with the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
And in my case, Bill, I have always been very interested and very involved, for that matter, in community service. And with retirement, of course, I had a lot more time. The more I heard about the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the more excited I became about the prospect of working for an organization like this. I didn't cut back, actually, on any of my other service obligations, so I have stayed extremely busy, even more so after retirement than I was when I was working full-time. I'm amazed at how much I've learned in all those capacities, so I've really appreciated the opportunity.
George, I have one final question for you. I first got to know you through your Minute for God spots on WPTF. Tell us a little more about that, how it got started and where it's gone and what you have as a vision for the future.
Well, thank you, Bill. Minute for God is, I guess, is kind of my own little personal ministry here. I have been interested for many years in trying to get a program on the air about the subject of religion and spirituality, but one that is a little bit broader than a lot of the programs that are heard on traditional religious radio stations. I was talking with the folks at Curtis Media that own WPTF Radio here in Raleigh a few years ago about the idea of a program, and they suggested to me that maybe we start out, instead of doing a long-form program, just doing a one-minute program. So it really started in February of 2009. The spot started airing on WPTF in Raleigh and also on a station that they own in Greensboro as well. Here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service, which I am absolutely thrilled about, it is a one-minute spot that's a kind of a little vignette that is about religion, and I cover all kinds of different topics there, and mostly dealing with Christianity, I would say, because that's the majority of the listener base, but also I get into talking about other faiths as well. The one message that I try to get across in virtually all the programs that I do is a feeling of inclusiveness. Have everybody try to find a common ground that they have with people in other faiths. Whether you agree with positions of a particular faith or not, there are some strong common threads in all faiths, and it's very fundamental.
Well, thank you, George and Randy, for joining us today on Take My Arm.
It's our pleasure, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. Pleasure to be here.
Time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air and another episode of Blind Justice with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin. The scene opens after the hoedown at the river crossing, and the crew arrives in Kansas City.
That was quite a hoedown, Bill. After all that dancing, my feet hurt so bad, I was actually glad to get back in the saddle.
Knowing you in saddles, that's a heap of dancing.
Well, we've got to get these cattle loaded in the boxcars.
And I've got a date with the cooking school. How many days before you start back?
I figure 5, allowing loading, paying off the boys, and giving them a rest.
I'll be back before you leave.
You need some help finding the place?
I think I can manage. See? Everything's up to date in Kansas City. It's right this way.
Say, old-timer, can I help you?
Yeah. I just came in from the river crossing with a herd of cattle. And I'm looking for a cooking school. Should be right around here close.
Wait a minute. You came in with a trail drive? By any chance, you wouldn't be the cook named Bill?
Everyone on the trail just calls me Cookie.
The same Cookie that tuned up that piano at the hoedown and then played 3 straight days for the boys?
You heard about that?
Woo-hoo! We've been hearing about nothing else. Fact is, I've been out on the street looking for you. My name is Bob, and I'm the manager of the Opera House here in town. We have a big show with Ginny Lind coming in tonight. And just this morning, our grand piano developed this funny sound, and we were kind of hoping you could help us out.
I reckon the cooking school can wait a few hours. Let me take your arm, and let's go have a look at this piano.
Right this way. Here, let me open the door for you.
If you don't mind, just let me touch the door, and I'll open it for myself. Saves running into a door that's somewhere I don't expect it to be.
Hadn't thought about that. After you.
Now, where's the piano?
It's right over there. Oh, sorry. Take my arm. It's right this way.
Let's have a listen. Mercy, what have we got here?
That's it. Piano wasn't even dropped or run into. It was working fine last night, and the stage crew was putting a final polish to her when all of a sudden...
You go ahead about your business. This is going to take me a while.
It's been 3 hours, and people are going to start coming in pretty soon. Any luck?
I'm baffled. I've checked all the tuning pins, felt down every string, checked the pedals, and no matter what I do...
What am I going to do?
I have one last hope, but I'm going to need some help.
I don't know anything about tuning pianos.
I don't need your ears. I need your eyes. Have you got a little lantern?
Well, yeah, there's one right over there. Sorry, I got it.
Point it right down here where I've got my finger. Now, turn off any other light close by. Ready? Now, tell me if you see anything.
Nope, nothing.
Not yet. Now.
I saw something flash.
Look again.
There it is. I need a little stick. Ah, there it is. It's a paper clip. It was lodged around the bottom of the wire. Now let's try. Hoo-hoo! That sounds okay.
We need the full test. There you are, ready for Jenny Lynn.
Oh, thank you kindly. Come back tonight and I'll have a special seat for you.
Thanks, but I have a date with a cooking school. Where did you say it was?
Right across the street and upstairs. Just follow the...
That proves something.
That everything's up to date in Kansas City?
Nope. Look what working together can do for...
Blind Justice.
Do we have time for a visit from Professor Bill?
For you, Bob, we'll make time.
You're going to make time for me?
Just for you.
Gee, I didn't know there was a recipe.
It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill.
The problem, we're in the kitchen trying out a new recipe, and the instructions say that measurements must be accurate. The recipe calls for 4 ounces of milk.
No problem. Just take out your 4-ounce measuring device and fill it up.
You can't find your 4-ounce measuring cup. You only have a 5-ounce and a 3-ounce.
Well, just estimate. You're a good cook.
Good enough to know that if the directions say to be accurate, you'd better be accurate.
Okay, okay. I go borrow the neighbors.
You can do it all by yourself. You have a 5-ounce and a 3-ounce. Make 4 ounces from them. Fill the 5-ounce container.
Okay.
Now pour that into the 3-ounce container. How much do you have left?
2 ounces.
Now take the container with the 3 ounces in it and pour it back into the bottle.
Now I have 2 ounces in the 5-ounce glass. Oh, I see. Put that into a bigger glass and do the whole thing all over again. I have 4 ounces.
You could do that, but it would be quicker to now pour those 2 ounces into the empty 3-ounce container and then refill the 5-ounce glass. Now simply fill the 3-ounce glass and...
I have 4 ounces left in a 5-ounce container.
With plenty of time to finish the recipe.
One of our listeners is Myra DeBruhl, a graduate of the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind.
She is also an old classmate of mine and had some memories of days back when we were there.
And any of you happen to be attendees of the Governor Moorhead School, this might bring back some memories.
This little, I guess you'd call it a poem, is called I Remember K Cottage, and it's just a few things that I remember learning while I was in K Cottage. One of those things, of course, was Braille. I remember the house mother saying, stand up or take them off, so I skated. And I remember that you can't sing or skate and cry at the same time. I also remember that we were supposed to pick up paper from the ground when most of us could not even see the ground. I remember the steam heat clanging the pipes early in the morning as if that heat was trying to either get in or get out. I remember the smell of ether. I remember the feel of a ruler across my bare bottom, being overjoyed to receive snail mail, large Christmas trees with bubble lights, going to school on Thanksgiving, lots of acorns, halo shampoo, dolls with heads as hard as mine, cane bottom rockers, that luggage room that always smelled of mothballs, city water, brogans, every 6th Friday, afternoon naps, and meeting Ronnie Millsap.
This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. We hope you've enjoyed today's stories about blind inventors.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. We invite your comments. Please call us at 919-832-5138. And if you would be able to help underwrite any of our programs, your financial support would be deeply appreciated. All donations go directly into keeping TRRS on the air. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Until next time,
goodbye.